Our next speaker is Professor Jay Pasikoff. I met Jay back almost 15 years ago on a trip over Finland for the total eclipse in 1990. He's world-renowned as one of the experts in physics of the corona, in experimental physics of the corona during eclipses. I know of no person alive who's seen more total eclipses than Jay. And it's a great pleasure to introduce him today to speak to us about science from eclipses and from the transit of Venus. Professor Pasikoff, if you're ready.
Thank you very much, Fred. It's a great pleasure to be on the program with Fred and some others of my distinguished colleagues. Obviously, we work together in many ways, and I am glad to have a chance to talk about some of these scientific experts and give some scientific background today to many of the things that we are discussing. There is another talk on these sessions that will be also about solar eclipse science that will be given tomorrow by Dr. Serge Kouchmi, who is here, who is a very distinguished solar scientist, and so I have not discussed any of his remarkable pursuits in my talk today. I'll leave those to Serge tomorrow, but I'll discuss a number of other aspects of scientific work. In the last 6 months, like so many other people, I have been working also on the transit of Venus, which has drawn the attention of so many of us and the pleasure of so many of us. So I will discuss that also. To give some background, we are discussing the eclipses, many parts of the sun, the outer parts of the sun, in particular the solar corona. The solar corona is millions of degrees in temperature, and the thing that I have been studying in particular is why, if we go up in the atmosphere of the sun after the photosphere and a slight rise of the chromosphere, does it very abruptly go up to millions of degrees. The corona is very much less dense in the lower levels of the sun, and somehow energy is being inserted into the corona to heat it that way. You all know that if you come up close to a stove and it's very hot, and you go away, it gets cooler. Well, with the sun, if you were up close to the sun's surface, and it's too hot and you went away, it would get even hotter, which is counterintuitive. And one of the things that we are working to explain is just why. And interestingly, the question of why the solar corona is millions of degrees hot is currently still an unsolved problem in astrophysics. Or shall I say, it's been solved definitively, but simultaneously by 20 different people with different answers. Now, the corona is very much fainter than the sun, and here we see a diagram of the brightness of the sun, and the corona is shown in these lines here, and normally the sky is up there somewhere. It gets very good, it might be there, and you see that we might see even just a little bit of corona, but basically we need an eclipse to be able to see this range of brightness of the corona. So, of course, that is why we are traveling to these solar eclipses. And we can turn the lights down, please. And here, just for background, is an eclipse looking over my shoulder. It's me in the foreground, one of my students with a telescope in the background in India at the eclipse of 1995. And the sun, however beautiful, is much smaller in the sky than one would think, just in general, or certainly one would think from seeing the close-up pictures that we all tend to take. But it's wonderful to see all the sky phenomena. The Romanian eclipse was notable not only for the corona, or well, I saw it from Romania, many of you saw it from other places, we've seen various citations, but also from the chromosphere. The chromos is color, of course, in Greek, so we get the chromosphere for a few seconds at the beginning and the end of the eclipse, and some prominences. One of the things that I have specialized in recently is compound images. We've been working really since the eclipse of 1984 and various techniques to compound various images, and you've seen a number of examples of that. And here's one of our images of the 1998 eclipse, and I also show this to show that we can now observe the disk of the sun during totality and see the corona, but to do that we have to look in the ultraviolet or the x-rays, and you have to look from space. There are spacecraft up that are doing this, and this is a picture from the extreme image, the extreme ultraviolet imaging telescope, or EIT, on the SOHO spacecraft, Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, a joint European Space Agency, NASA spacecraft, and by putting that image there, you can begin to try to trace the solar streamers back to the bases on the surface of the sun. So, for example, at an eclipse, we can take an image like this, and SOHO will make an image of the disk of the sun, and then a different experiment on SOHO, the LASCO experiment, Large Angle Spectrographic Coronagraph, run by the Naval Research Laboratory, can make an artificial eclipse and see the very outermost part of the sun. But as of the year 2004, we still do not have the capabilities in space of making as good an eclipse as we see naturally from the ground. So we still have some window of maybe some decades for this niche of scientific eclipse observing, when there are things that we can see that are not and cannot be observed from space. So we can try to put together this space image in the middle and our eclipse image, and you see the streamers leading out to the outer coronal streamers, again from space, and try to get a unified image of the solar corona over a wide range. In particular, the solar wind is formed in this lower part in here, and so at eclipses we are observing the formation region of the solar wind. Another experiment on LASCO, on SOHO, is this ultraviolet coronagraphic spectrometer, UVCS, and we've been using that also recently to observe the edge of the sun, the chromosphere. But here's some UVCS observations. You can see the very lowest corona from it. And here is a composite that we made at the 1999 eclipse with our process eclipse image in the middle zone between the spacecraft image in the middle and the spacecraft image outside, showing the streamer quite far out, even further than the pictures that Glenn showed in our joint observations from the high altitude airplane, although it was fun in the airplane to be able to go out to about there, and we will be working to put even more of that together with the space observations. One of the kinds of observations, another kind of observation I've made, has involved the spectrum of the corona. And the basic underlying black and white there is the spectrum of the sun across the visible, from the blue, violet, through the blue here, and not really going into the red. And if you do a three-dimensional modeling calculation, you can see that these lines, when they bounce off the electrons in the high-temperature corona, broaden the spectrum and wash out the individual spectral lines. And so the coronal spectrum from scattering off those electrons is very smooth, and depending on just what the coronal temperature is, if you do the modeling, you can see that they're smooth to different degrees. And so if we can measure very precisely just what the intensity of the corona is at these wavelengths, then we can go back and calculate what the temperature of the corona is. And this is an independent way of measuring the temperature of the corona, an independent way of showing that the temperature is very hot and finding out what that temperature is. And so that's an experiment that my students and I have been carrying out at the last few eclipses. Here's one of our compound images from the 1999 eclipse. And we have been working in conjunction with scientists from the Transition Region and Coronal Explorer, the TRACE spacecraft, which gives very high resolution observations of a small region of the solar limb in particular in a variety of ultraviolet and white light lines. And I'll come back to work that I've been doing jointly with Glenn Schneider using the TRACE spacecraft on the transit of Venus. The TRACE spacecraft is a magnificent spacecraft, and I've recently been using it together with the Swedish Solar Telescope observations to observe the details on the limb. On this occasion, in 1999, we measured the solar continuum, and we also used a filter at the so-called coronal green line, which shows the coronal structure, and this is actual emission from the corona. This is now no longer the scattering off the electrons in the corona, but actually iron atoms that are heated to such a high temperature that they've lost half of their 26 electrons. We've been addressing the question of why the corona is so hot by looking for oscillations, for waves that are passing through that level of the corona, and following some theoretical results that showed there could be oscillations with periods as fast as about 1 second. We observed 10 times a second, that's 10 hertz, in the two channels, and we observed the continuum channel as a monitor to make sure there aren't sky fluctuations, atmospheric fluctuations. So by taking a ratio of the coronal channel and the continuum channel, we can calibrate out those fluctuations. And we used our 0.35 Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope and the CCD operating in a very fast mode. So we are routinely carrying about a ton of equipment around with us to these eclipses and looking for these intensity oscillations at fairly high resolution, a couple of arcseconds per pixel. The sky is not better quality than that usually during an eclipse. We carried out an analysis of the pixels, and one of the things we wanted to make sure of was that we are really seeing a real effect, that it's not some background effect, and by doing that we're looking in the spectral loops themselves to see that that where the corona is brightest, we are seeing effects, and we can see some signs that there are oscillatory phenomena going on at about 1 hertz that you don't see when you're not looking at the coronal loop. And we went on to map where these things are concentrated, and we can see the variations of intensity of those oscillations. A newer technique than the old Fourier transform is something called wavelet analyses, which we are doing to further our observations of these oscillations. And using these techniques, we are showing that, again, that there are oscillations down to about 1% of the total intensity of the light. So these are not full oscillations. These are low-level oscillations, which one does have to study carefully to pull out. And here's a comparison again of our continuum channel for comparison and our spectral line channel on the right. And the wavelet analysis of time on this horizontal axis versus frequency shows where there are oscillations and what zones there are oscillations. And these are data that we are putting together with theoretical results to try to resolve which models of coronal heating, which kinds of injection of energy, which kinds of waves in the magnetic field probably are bringing energy into the corona to heat it to millions of degrees. So we are finding these oscillations in the loops, and we are continuing that work. Proceeding, we're also using some of the space, some of the ground-based observations to compare with spacecraft in a different way. We'd like to calibrate the spacecraft. For example, once the spacecraft goes up, you don't really know what the what's happening to the optics there. And by getting ground-based observations with a very dark sky of an eclipse from the ground, you can compare with these ground-based results to see what the scattered light is in the instrumental systems in the spacecraft. So we built a ground-based telescope similar in size and resolution with a similar filter to the coronal green line that was used in the SOHO spacecraft LASCO experiment, and this is an example of our observations from the 1998 eclipse for use for comparison with LASCO. Again, this is a somewhat processed image. In 1999, we were right on the star in Fred's map in Romania, the only time I think I've been right in the middle of the eclipse, which I think is a nice place to be. You'll hear a different opinion from Tom Van Flerenden together tomorrow. And here we see Jupiter in the sky along with the eclipsed sun and our telescope, our 30.35-meter telescope in the foreground. We used a variety of observations to bring out the structure in the streamers, and this processing has been done. These has been done together with my colleague Bryce Babcock, Steve Martin, and student Dan Seaton. I've been fortunate to work with Wendy Carlos, who some of you know, in putting together the photographic observations to bring out the structure in the solar corona, and then we can use those observations to together with the CCD observations that provide higher resolution studies to really see the structure, to see the streamers and the structure in the bases of the streamers, for example, and relate them to features on the surface of the sun. And here is an image that you saw before, then extending that outward to try to follow the structures from the surface of the sun out through the middle corona that we observe and out into space. Remember, of course, that half the sun is invisible, and so we would only expect about half the streamers that we see to come back to features on the visible side of the sun. So here we are with this photographic observations with the EIT inserted to help follow those structures. Going back to Fred's map, then we see the most recent eclipses that went across Africa to Australia here, or across Antarctica. We had a team observing in Ceduna, Australia for 2002, and we had with us a set of experiments to do that matching with the space observations and in the ways I've described and to look for the coronal oscillations, and also we had some additional cameras that you see here taking images fairly low in the sky of the eclipse. So here is the biggest of the telescopes here, and then some smaller telescopes, and this is the one that matches the SOHO observations. And the police were out giving us some protection with official signs from Ceduna. A problem we have in many places that I'm sure many of you have run into is a lack of understanding of when to look at a total eclipse and what the difference is between a total eclipse and a partial eclipse, and we'll hear more about this from Ralph Chow later on. We were fortunate at our location in Ceduna to have a huge hole in the clouds, and we were able to view the eclipse from a very clear place. So moving on from the Ceduna eclipse to the Antarctic eclipse, I was fortunate to be on the flight that Glenn had arranged, and we worked together, as you saw, in putting together a CCD camera. We were glad to see a little view looking down in Antarctica at a mountain. We were glad to see before we left, with some other people who are here in this room, some little penguins in the coast of Australia. I guess that picture isn't going to appear, that last picture. And here is one of the images that you saw before, taken with a 400-millimeter lens on a Nikon F5 and some processing. Here's a series of three images we took with the shadow. Notice coming in from the right, moving across in the middle of totality, and going off on the left. and then the diamond ring effect, a very beautiful eclipse from 2003, and we did what we could from high altitude. This is with the SBIG CCD that we were glad to have that worked reliably with the streamers extending out to quite a great distance. It was a pleasure to see a partial eclipse on April 19th, just to show you the most recent eclipse that occurred. Here again is one of Fred's maps. It was here in Cape Town. And there's Tony Farrell of the University of Cape Town, of Planetarium in Cape Town, just to show you the most recent eclipse that there was a partial eclipse visible in southern Africa a few months ago. And then some of us are going to gather in Hawaii in October for the next eclipse. I think Fred is going to be there, is that right? And I know Patrick and Joanne are going to be there, and some other people here are going to be there. So if any of you come, please let us know. And then, of course, there's the hybrid eclipse that we will intercept here west of the Galapagos with Jen and Vic Winters. We have some websites that discuss these things. Fred, I believe I have more time, though.
You do?
Yes.
That's just the halfway point.
Well, I have to be just about halfway.
Okay.
So you have me worried there. Good. So we have some websites which I put together on behalf of the International Astronomical Union Program Group on public information at the times of eclipses, because those are times when we get a lot of newspaper publicity. We have the attention of the newspapers and of the people in the various countries, and so we have a website at www.eclipses.info and a related eclipse at totalsolareclipse.net. And then a lot of my archive is at williams.edu/astronomy/eclipse. And then the ship out of the Galapagos next year, which Fred Espenak will be, and David Eicher from Astronomy Magazine will be, at astronomicaltours.net. And so we will be out there. And then, of course, we're all looking forward to the eclipse of 2006 across Africa and some parts of Europe and into Asia there. Really, Abkhazia is one of the places. I'm not going to go right in the edge of Georgia, but the eclipse, I think, goes right there. So I'm now going to move from the eclipse into the transit of Venus. As I mentioned before, the transit of Venus is a tenth of a percent annual eclipse. And I've been very interested in transferring some of my attention to it for the last year, really, and working in particular with Glenn Schneider on a whole range of things, and also my two colleagues at Williams College, Bryce Babcock and Steve Souza. Here's a group of us at the 20-centimeter refractor of the University of Thessaloniki, the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki in northern Greece. My summer students have just finished working this summer on various things, and we thank the National Geographic Society especially for their support of our expedition. Here is a historical transit of Venus. Let me go through a little bit of the background very quickly. Some of this is background for what Daniel Fisher was talking about this morning. Here's Venus transiting across the Sun from a book by Doppelmayr, so we've been hearing about that that too. And here's another kind of transit or eclipse of Venus, which has been happening fairly often recently. The background of the reason for studying the transit of Venus started with Copernicus's famous book in 1543 and his famous diagram with Sol, the sun, at the center here. And this was translated into English a few years later in an appendix by Thomas Diggs to a book by his father. And finally, we have this first English language version of the Copernican diagram with the sun at the center, and you can see that only Venus and Mercury can go in transit across the face of the sun. So there's Venus, and until the distances were known in the solar system, nobody had any idea what was what. So for example, here's the size of the Sun, and here's the size of Jupiter and Mars and the Earth from 1556, before any of these distances were known. And they just didn't know, and it certainly looked very different from what we now know to be the relative sizes you see here in this montage of NASA images. We owe Kepler for his laws to figure this all out. His first law just about ellipses, and his second law about the speed at different points in the elliptical orbits are certainly interesting, but for the importance of the transit of Venus, we use his third law, which links the square of the periods of the planets to the cubes of the semi-major axes, the sizes of their orbits. And so the question is how big their orbits are. Kepler himself made tables, the Rudolphine tables, but those were not ephemerides, those were tables, and you had to make calculations with them. He succeeded in predicting the eclipse, the transits of 1631 of Mercury and Venus, and the Mercury one was visible from Europe, the Venus one was not, and he didn't predict 1639, but as most people here know, Jeremiah Horrocks went on to do that, and he wrote his friend Crabtree, and the two of them succeeded in seeing that transit, and then there's a gap of 121 and a half years. So here's a 19th century picture, late 19th century, of Horrocks observing the transit from the Walker Art Museum in Liverpool. And here's Halley, who then first made the predictions, the analysis of a method for finding the distance to Venus by parallax. And then, to go back to that Kepler third law that I just showed, since proportionalities govern the size of the solar system, you didn't know how far anything was away until you found any one distance. And so I stress that finding this one distance from the Earth to Venus then enabled you to find the whole scale of the solar system because the proportionalities were known. But as we saw with Daniel Fisher's talk, something arose between Venus and the Sun as Venus went inside the Sun, known as the black drop effect, and Halley's method wanted predictions to a second or two, and the things were uncertain to a minute or two, so all the things were most uncertain. Captain Cook was sent by the British Admiralty to Tahiti to observe the transit in 1769, and a transcription of the journal, just to make it easier to read. We had every advantage and desire in observing the whole of the passage of the Sun. We very soon saw an atmosphere, which is wrong, or just a shade of the planet, which disturbed the times of the contacts. And we can now show that that was not the correct statement. But and they observed, and they differed from one another, observing the times of the contacts much more than could be expected. So that is the black drop effect, and here's a diagram by Charles Green, the astronomer, who in fact did not survive the trip. So we hope for better for all of us in our observing, but here is the atmosphere on the top, then the black drop effect here, and here's Captain Cook's own drawings of the black drop effect here, confusing the issue. And then Captain Cook proceeded to meander around what we now call New Zealand and the east coast of Australia. So I consider those explorations a spin-off of astronomical research. Once photography was developed, they didn't do much better. Here are some 1882 photographs by the American astronomer Francis Moran Mitchell and one of the U.S. Naval Observatory's images. And those are the best photographs we had up until a month or so ago. We started observing, working with the observations that Trace made of the transit of Mercury, and this work from now on is going to be joined with Glenn Schneider, and here is a series of the observations, and it turns out that if you try to observe just when the contact was here, you can see this black drop effect gave an uncertainty, a considerable uncertainty. And here is a faint black drop effect in the transit of Mercury. Now note that Mercury has no atmosphere, unlike Venus, so it's not the atmosphere of the planet, and we're observing from outside the Earth's atmosphere, so it was not the Earth's atmosphere that was doing it, yet we're seeing a black drop effect. Here are the equal intensity contours showing that, and here is some analysis showing that there is some inherent blurring from the the telescope itself, from the finite size of the telescope, but there's also an effect you have to take into account of the solar limb darkening. In fact, the sun is darker near its edge, and those two effects together entirely compensate for the black drop, and with those effects removed, you see then a perfectly symmetric image. So armed with those observations, we set out to observe the transit of Venus of 2004. We wanted to make both ground based and space observations with TRACE, and I do thank NASA for a guest investigator time on TRACE also, and we observed from here in northern Greece. You already saw a picture of our group there earlier, and we were very pleased with the observations that we got. Here's a digital observation. Here you can see the solar limb darkening very clearly on this image. And we worked with Leon Golub and Ed DeLuca at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and Carl Shriver from Lockheed Martin in running TRACE. And here is a processing that Glenn did on the TRACE images, just to give you a sample of what we have. And you can see the ingress here. You can see the atmosphere become visible and then brighten. You can see how sharp it is there. You can see how big the sun actually is on these images. So we're looking at very high resolution with half arc second pixels, and therefore 1 second resolution. And there are many more of these observations and movies with these observations on the website. Well, it's on Glenn's website, and there's a link to that from transitofvenus.info. It's www.transitofvenus.info, and there are links to whole galleries of things, but also links to these results. So we're very pleased with the way the atmosphere shows so clearly there. And then we can follow the atmosphere in. And these are just two different demonstrations, color tables, so to speak, showing the time of the black drop effect, and a very slight black drop effect looks like it's visible, particularly there on the lower left, and these are things that are still under study. After all, it's only about a couple of months since the transit. Here's some preliminary reduction that Glenn did of the limb darkening here. Taking it out from the background, puts it in to the disk of Venus, and Venus, as you see, is much bigger than the Mercury appeared in these images, and we do have a small black drop effect that we must analyze, and that's work that remains to be done. We were also working with a different spacecraft, the so-called ACRIM spacecraft, the active cavity radiometer, which is measuring the total intensity of the sun. This is something that used to be called the solar constant, when we used to think the sun's intensity was constant. Now it's technically called the total solar irradiance, but we can still call it the solar constant for short. And I realized sometime before the eclipse that its accuracy was such it should be able to see a tenth of a percent effect of Venus going in front of the sun. And we worked with Bob Wilson of ACRIM, who built ACRIM and runs the ACRIMSAT, to monitor at an increased rate. And here are the observations before, and here is the transit going down from 1366 to 1364 watts per square meter. And just to change that unit to percentages, you can see that there's a drop of just about a tenth of a percent, just as you would expect from Venus being a 30th diameter of the Sun angularly, and the 30 square is 900. Now, another interesting thing here is that it doesn't drop between first contact and second contact so abruptly, as you might expect geometrically, but it is rather a slower decline, and it took me a minute to realize that that's the solar limb darkening that we're seeing. So we're actually measuring the solar limb darkening from this gradual occultation that we are seeing here. And then the spacecraft is in orbit around the sun, and it is occulted by the Earth for a third of each orbit. So there are these gaps here. There's still a little missing data. We're hoping we've filled it, but there are gaps that are unrecoverable, including the time between third and fourth contact. But we are nonetheless seeing this limb darkening here just before third contact. And here, the occultation periods are shown in shaded, and you can actually fit this. And even more astonishing, as the spaceship goes around the Earth and gives us the parallax of the whole Earth diameter from north to south and a little more, the parallax brings Venus on and off the limb darkening a little bit, and we hope that this effect is real. We're still looking at that, but we may even be seeing the parallax effect on the solar limb darkening in this tenth of a percent transit of Venus across the face of the sun. So those observations, not yet these focal solar irradiance ones, which are being shown here for the first time, I think, outside our private discussions. In general, things are available not only at eclipses.info that I mentioned before, but also at www.transitofvenus.info, and we will continue to study these very interesting effects. And thank you for letting me tell you about them.
What's the time for the rest of your
Acrim
operators?
There's one I think it's every 128 seconds, as I recall, is the time interval.
Oh, yeah, but the time answer, if there is no
there's an independent measurement every 2 minutes.
And there is no correlation. You don't keep a memory.
Those are not schools with any memory. They should be independent observations every 28 seconds. Daniel?
The drop of solar radiation during the transit was also observed by another satellite, SALS, with the TMI experiment, the TIM experiment. And if I just look at the printout of this, it looks rather different, the curve they have. They have much steeper slopes during ingress and egress than you. Not as V-shaped, but more like this. How is it possible?
Different wavelength?
Yeah, this is a bolometer that's integrating from 0.2 to 2 microns. Mm-hmm. When you integrate over the whole band pass, it's a much shallower slope. You have to really look at what's happening with limb darkening over that broad wavelength division.
Mm-hmm.
I can make one last comment, then. My wife and I were visiting the Maritime Museum in Connecticut, Mystic Seaport, last month, and they showed me that in 1843, and they gave me a page from the log of the Charles W. Morgan, the last wooden whaler made in the 1840s, in June 27th, Tuesday, June 27th, 1843, it said, "Saw the sun totally eclipsed." And I looked up the path, and there was a very narrow hybrid eclipse right through the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And then they only pointed out maybe it's in the same Sahara, and if you divide 1823, the difference between then and now, it's 9 Saharas later. And of course, each 3 Saharas will give you a third times 3, or a complete time around. So we are now about to have this same eclipse that the Charles W. Morgan and its captain and crew saw in 1843.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jay. I'm going to turn it over to Patrick to announce our break.
We have a coffee break, and for those who want tea, is also a tea break. So we see each other back at 4 o'clock, please. Thank you.